From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. There's much more to Maryland cuisine than crab cakes and Old Bay. Have you tasted peanut pickle sandwiches and Baltimore caramels or sipped tomato wine? Kara Mae Harris has. The food enthusiast and recipe sleuth is painstakingly preserving Maryland's culinary heritage across dozens of decades, one recipe at a time. Harris tests favorites and reports back on her blog, Old Line Plate. She's also created a searchable database of more than 30,000 recipes and has made some surprising discoveries.
Almost every food item that I've ever researched in old newspapers, I find somebody who died from eating it. Food poisoning and purity of food, it was a big problem.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Traditional family recipes passed down from generation to generation bring warm memories to the dinner table. They can provide a sense of culture and lineage. Whether handwritten note cards or bound volumes of dog-eared pages, these artifacts help fill in details of history. Our guest today works diligently in that vein, but her aim is broader than one family's traditions. Her goal is to preserve the culinary heritage of the entire state of Maryland over dozens of decades. Writer and recipe sleuth Kara Mae Harris is here to talk about her blog, Old Line Plate, and the database of more than 30,000 recipes she's cataloged. Harris is also an admissions coordinator at the Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health. Welcome to On the Record.
Good morning.
How did you get started with this project?
Well, my mother had these Southern Heritage, it's like a cookbook library, and I was, you know, just looking, using them as a reference, and I came across recipes with Maryland in the title, things I'd never heard of, like Maryland white potato pie.
White potato pie.
Yeah, so it's essentially like a sweet potato pie, but it's white potatoes and seasoned with lemon juice, and that's about it, some nutmeg. So I was unfamiliar with some of these, and it hadn't occurred to me really that Maryland, outside of crab cakes, even had a cuisine. So I just got a lot more interested in it and started, one book leads to another, and I eventually started collecting these cookbooks and kind of consolidating them into a database so I could figure out where they originated.
Well, okay, how did you get from collecting recipes to thinking database?
I'm a data person. It just made sense. One of the main cookbooks that people refer to when they think of old Maryland recipes is Eat, Drink, and Be Merry in Maryland. But a lot of those recipes are sourced from different people around the state and their big Maryland manors. So I just wanted to connect the people and places and recipes to each other in kind of a visual way or in a data way, if that makes sense.
How old are the recipes? I mean, what time period do you focus on?
I am really interested in recipes that are from right around the turn of the 19th century. That was a big time for cookbooks. That was a big time for publishing. Mrs. Benjamin Chu Howard put out a book in 1880 called 50 Years in a Maryland Kitchen, and it's full of hundreds, if not thousands, of recipes. Some of them are untested and ridiculous. Some of them are redundant. You know, and other
You're very
similar.
Judgmental about these recipes.
If you look at a lot of these recipes, I mean, there's things like toast water for the sick, you know, take some stale toast and boil it in a cup of water and feed that to your sick child instead of tea, because tea would just be too exciting, I guess.
That does sound pretty awful.
Yeah, and more than you would think, a lot of the recipes are just things that if you go through the internet today and just keep clipping things you want to make and you never get around to, that's nothing new. People would collect recipes from newspapers or friends and just reprint them, never get around to trying them, and they sometimes would get ingredients left off. Things would get a little bit like a game of telephone, and you have a recipe that just doesn't quite work out.
You don't test every recipe you collect, do you?
No, there's just so many.
Tell me more about how you track down the cookbooks and the recipes you collect.
I spend a lot of time at the Enoch Pratt Free Library. They have a huge collection of community cookbooks, and they'll have names of people who contributed recipes, and sometimes they'll even mention the recipe came from another book or a newspaper, so then I kind of find it on Google, and one thing leads to another. There's also a good manuscript collection at the Maryland Historical Society. Women would collect manuscripts. A lot of those are housed at the Historical Society. They would sometimes clip things from newspapers or women's magazines like Good Housekeeping, which was around the 1800s. Other magazines like The Delineator that we might not have heard of today. And they'd have puzzles and different fiction stories and then recipes, and women would clip the recipes into a book and perhaps try them and perhaps not. Or they would copy recipes from their neighbors and friends. So some of them are really valuable historical documents, and some of them are more abstract, where they give you an insight into what someone dreamed about doing rather than what they were really going to eat for dinner that night.
Tell us more about this blog. What can people find if they visit Old Line Plate?
Well, about once a week, I try to pick something from my database and actually see what it tastes like. So that could be anything from peanut pickle sandwich filling that somebody clipped from the paper in 1920 to something more modern. And then there's a few older documents that I've tried. A lot of those can be fairly obscure. The instructions will often be vague, you know, mix these five ingredients and then cook it until it's done. So it's a lot of interpretation. But each week I make a recipe and taste it and kind of then do research into the background of either the ingredients or the recipe's author or the book, or sometimes maybe something on a bit of a tangent like Thanksgiving in Maryland, something like that.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Kara Mae Harris about her blog Old Line Plate and her research deep into historic Maryland recipes. You started a blog and then the database took precedence.
Yeah, I kind of took a break from the blog to just gather all this information so that I could be a little bit more informed when I went back into it.
And so now you've resumed the blog.
Yes.
And the blog is where people can find the database?
There is a link on there, and I've made the main index available to researchers so that you can see this massive list of Maryland recipes and the books they came from and information about those books.
And tell us what kind of connections you've made because of the database.
I have found, for instance, a document at, I think, the Antiquarian Society. They have some digital items available, one of which is a Maryland and Virginia cookbook, and it happened to contain a recipe that was credited to the Dutch Tea House in Baltimore, which was a tea house on Charles Street that we wouldn't have heard of today because that was around 1904. So then I was able to research that locale. I've also found some recipes in actual manuscripts that made their way into Eat, Drink, and Be Merry in Maryland, you know, connected with different Maryland manors that usually were essentially plantations. And that was something that was really glorified in a lot of those books.
Eat, Drink, and Be Merry in Maryland. This is something you reference quite a bit, a cookbook you reference quite a bit on your blog. When was it published?
Yeah, it's an amazing document. We're so lucky to have that here. Frederick Philip Stief, who belonged to the Stief family of, you know, pianos and silver, he went around Maryland and collected all of these recipes and put them together in a book. It was published in the 1930s, and it's been a reference full of Maryland recipes ever since.
So it's from the 1930s looking backward at recipes that were already historic then?
Or at least considered historic. There's sometimes you can question the provenance of a recipe to some extent, but for the most part it is pretty accurate, I would say. It's not colonial necessarily, but there's a lot of family recipes in there from the Ridgelys of Hampton and places like that around Maryland. There's a recipe for bear steaks from Garrett County.
You write about the significance of community cookbooks in your research. Talk about that.
Community cookbooks started as a way for women to raise money for charitable causes, usually a church. I particularly like them because oftentimes the authors of the recipes will be credited, so you'll have a list of an entire community of usually women. And I can do research on these people and find out things about their lives. but they also serve to spread recipes. And it's an interesting example of the ways that recipes kind of went out into the world and grew and became their own thing. I found that different cookbooks are kind of a living document almost. Someone would have their cookbook and jot more recipes into it, and even no two printed cookbooks are alike. They each become their own special item for the different members of the community that owned them.
Can you trace the route, which version of a recipe came first and second and third through these community cookbooks?
We can try, but it's not always easy. The best we can do is just find the first printed example, and I've definitely done that before. When I made a pie in the fall for Thanksgiving, I found it in the Buckeye Cookbook, which is a Midwestern cookbook, and it made its way to Maryland into Granny's Goodies from Somerset County. So it was obviously something that someone had held on to and passed on, and it became a Maryland recipe at that point.
What do you hear about how the database has been useful to others? How is it being used?
I like to think that it's something that will build over time. I do know that Joyce White, who's working on a book, has used it to cross-reference some of the recipes she's found, just to see. A lot of these women would have copied things into their manuscripts from published cookbooks, so it's good for verifying that. One entry that I wrote was about a recipe called A Nice Little Dish of Beef.
Nice Little Dish of Beef.
Yeah, essentially chopped up roast beef with some onions to be served in a clam shell or scallop shell. And I was really curious why this was called this, where it came from, and found it several times throughout Maryland recipes. And ultimately, I traced it back to Mary Randolph, who was a Virginia cookbook author who published one of the first kind of Southern cookbooks in the 1800s. And for whatever reason, she named this recipe A Nice Little Dish of Beef, and nobody bothered to come up with a more catchy name for it throughout history.
There's so many interesting side points here. We need to take a quick break here. Kara Mae Harris, who blogs at Old Line Plate, is with us. We're talking about her work to preserve historic Maryland recipes. When we come back from our quick break, we'll ask about the politics of food. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Katz. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking with Kara Mae Harris about her research into Maryland's culinary past and her work to preserve that history. Her blog, Old Line Plate, is an online record of her discoveries. On your blog, you have even mapped out the recipes from cookbooks across the state. Why is that important?
I did that specifically with the Eat, Drink, and Be Merry in Maryland, just to connect it with some of the great work that like Maryland Historical Trust has done, where they have these documents that photograph these locations, these historic locations throughout the state. So I put that all on a map so that you could find a recipe near you or near a historical site in your county, and to see how these recipes are distributed throughout the state. You're going to see more recipes from the Eastern Shore just because of the bounty from the Chesapeake that's available there, but also Baltimore, of course, since it's a culinary center, and then a few really odd recipes like the bear steaks from Western Maryland. So I thought I'd see them on a map and look for trends.
You mentioned that often early recipes just kind of list some ingredients and say, cook it till it's done. No specific amounts. No details about how to prepare.
Yeah, there's a real expectation of a certain amount of knowledge on the part of the person reading the recipe. You would have to know your own oven or even your own fire and know how hot it's going to be, so no one could really tell you how long to cook something. As for mixing ingredients, maybe you have experience in making cakes and breads, or your flour would be a lot different. So you'd have to use your own judgment a lot more than we would if we buy all-purpose flour.
So you mentioned oven or know your own fire. So that kind of very general recipe instruction stemmed from a time when people were cooking over open fires?
Or a hearth, a brick hearth. Some people certainly were cooking maybe in a Dutch oven over a fire, but it would just vary so much what people had access to. Now, if you print a recipe, you can just assume that anyone making that recipe has a stove that they can turn on hot, medium, low. They have an oven that they can know what temperature it's even at, and you couldn't know things like that before, so they just kind of left it out and let you wing it.
Well, as you trace the evolution of recipes, when do you see details start to show up, not just about what the temperature should be, but how to handle these ingredients?
Yeah. Fanny Farmer famously brought ingredient measurements into a standard with her Boston Cooking School in the late 1800s, and that was adopted very quickly. And then the gas and electric companies began to print cookbooks to promote their products, and those are going to tell you how to use their products. So you would have a little bit more of an explanation of how to cook a cake in an oven because they want you to buy their oven.
There was a point where cooking schools became quite popular. Talk about that.
So in the late 19th century, a lot of social factors combined to bring about the need for cooking schools. It was starting to be seen as more of a scientific thing, more of a duty of a woman to feed her family the most nutritious food. Also, coming from the South, you had women who didn't really know how to cook because they had had enslaved people who were doing their cooking for them. So cooking schools became a real middle class trend and a way to disseminate recipes. And that's when you'll really find a lot of more northern recipes slowly making their way into the South, including Maryland.
In March, the online newsletter Gastro Obscura featured an interview with you. And in reference to some of the strange-sounding recipes you've discovered, you said, quote, "A lot of the stuff people think is weird is just the lost concept of umami in Western food. It was totally there. People were using funky oysters and mushroom powder and anchovies, and for some reason just stopped," close quote. Have you discovered an answer about why the use of those foods stopped?
Not entirely. I've read people theorizing that anti-immigrant sentiment from the cooking schools and the kind of progressive movement brought people away from using a lot of seasonings and things like that, essentially fish sauce, anchovies and food, things like that. But I can't say for sure. There's so much going on with food sanitation and ingredients, you know, purity of ingredients, that it's hard to really say if it was one thing. And most of the time when something happens in history, it's not just because of one thing. It's a combination of factors that has a, you know, widespread change in the way that people eat.
That's Kara Mae Harris here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. She's telling us about her blog, Old Line Plate, and her research deep into historic Maryland recipes. How do recipes reflect sort of political history?
Especially in Maryland, what I've learned, and I never grew up considering Maryland the South per se. That's a very dicey topic that gets people passionate. But I've learned from these cookbooks that, especially by Mrs. B.C. Howard and Mrs. Charles Gibson on the Eastern Shore, these women who had been plantation mistresses essentially put out cookbooks that glorified the Southern way of living, and they contain a lot of recipes that are purposely meant to kind of evoke a nostalgia for antebellum Maryland.
Southern way of living is code for
slavery. Yeah, absolutely. And they kind of just erase the enslaved people and their role in creating the food completely from it. It becomes just the book that Mrs. B.C. Howard wrote, but certainly she wasn't the main one cooking that food when she was overseeing Belvedere here in Baltimore.
So what are the kind of recipes that show up?
A big one is Maryland beaten biscuits. It involves 40 minutes of beating some dough to beat air into it instead of leavening. And that's obviously just not something that people, especially these upper class white women were going to spend their time doing. So you see that a lot in Southern cookbooks, and it was really something that a lot of Northern people looked down upon and kind of tacitly associated with slavery.
But it shows up in Maryland cookbooks.
Yeah, and it's a classic Maryland recipe, and people still do make them today, and it's part of our heritage, certainly. There are still people who make them, sell them on the Eastern Shore. But at the time they came out in these cookbooks, it was sort of a way to evoke a little bit of a nostalgia about that.
Something else I learned from you via that Gastro Obscura interview is that there is a strain of fudge that is specific to Baltimore.
I learned that from, it's called Iconic American Desserts. It was a book that just came out by Stella Parks. She's a Serious Eats Food Network person. And she pretty much pinned the origins of fudge around the Baltimore region based on letters that people had written to each other. Fudge was known as a college girl kind of food to be made in dormitories. It's often associated with Vassar College. But the original Vassar student who made it had said that she got the recipe from a cousin in Baltimore, actually. And I did find a lot of recipes from around here that resemble that fudge recipe with just chocolate and brown sugar and cook it until it's
done. As someone who considers fudge one of the major food groups, I would have thought it goes back further than women attending college.
Yeah, it's not much further, no, because people weren't really doing that with chocolate at the time. People were drinking chocolate up until they were, you know, turning it into candy in the 1800s.
In the About section of your blog, you make the point that your work is not about romanticizing the past. Why is that distinction so important to you?
Almost every food item that I've ever researched in old newspapers, I find somebody who died from eating it.
Ugh.
Food poisoning and purity of food, it was a big problem, and it's something we take for granted because we think of farm fresh past where everything's so pure, but people died from adulterated food, people died from spoiled food. And they didn't know why. They didn't know what was happening. People were sometimes accused of poisoning people. It might have been cases of food poisoning. So I think that we shouldn't look at it through rose-colored glasses. I certainly would prefer to eat fresh peas over canned peas, but those canned peas could have been a life-saving advance in science for a lot of people.
What else can you tell us about the evolution of sanitation?
I mean, really, canned foods, when they first came out, weren't the frowned upon kind of thing that people think of now when they think about fresh and organic. Canned food was the height of sanitation and safety. It was almost the exact opposite of what you have now. And people were a lot more creative with canned foods at the time. I've seen recipes that call for canned lobster Newberg.
Besides canning, what other evolution have you seen?
So flour and things, for instance, you could buy flour that had been adulterated with cement in the 1800s, if you didn't know your miller that well, you could buy food that was contaminated or had been watered down, all kinds of things. There was just no regulation, really, to stop people from taking advantage of consumers. So things became a little bit more, quote-unquote, pure. You know, you always see purity as the buzzword on food in the early 1900s, purity and sanitation. People didn't necessarily know about ways different things would react. So if you put something acidic in a clay jar with a certain kind of glaze, you could poison yourself. And it's significant enough that some old cookbooks have a warning about not doing that. So
there's a lot you can learn from cookbooks.
Yeah.
You must have invested thousands of hours into this project. How will you know when you're done?
I originally planned to do the blog for 2 years. I committed myself to that, and there's so much more to try and taste and cook and research. I'm actually going to do some traveling to look at some Maryland manuscripts that are housed at other states. So I'll be done when I find something else that's more interesting to me.
Well, I really appreciate your telling us about it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Kara Mae Harris works to preserve historic Maryland recipes. She explores the Old Line State's foodways and cooking traditions at her blog, Old Line Plate. We have a link to her blog at the On the Record page at wypr.org. I'm Sheila Katz. Thanks for listening. On the Record, come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.